Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the Chicago Press Corps, D.C. I almost said D.C. Press Corps. What's the difference, really? They're both just propaganda arms of the identitarian socialists, the new Marxists in this country. So the ad that we started talking about yesterday that Lori Lightfoot went after, what was it, on Tuesday?
Yeah.
Just another wonderful case study in when there is a insatiable demand for racism, they will create the supply where the supply doesn't exist. We've given you countless examples. We've talked about innumerable number of stories over the years. And so now it's just a case study that involves me and my PAC in this race for governor here in Illinois in 2022, with Lori Lightfoot being a germane player in the race, not just because she's up for re-election early next year, but also because when you talk about public safety and the lack of it in Chicago and in Illinois, also with what is in the offing, with the Safety Act and the elimination of cash bail statewide, which has essentially been the de facto position of the Cook County State's Attorney and law enforcement and the political power structure in Chicago, Cook County, then you're talking about the mayor, you're talking about the Cook County prosecutor, you're talking about the judicial system in Cook County, and you're talking, about all of the players involved, including the General Assembly, in crafting and passing and signing this abdication of responsibility to provide for people's physical security in this state and in the city.
But instead of focusing on that, they're focused on you. And now Governor Pritzker has come forward saying that you should take down the end. There's no room for this type of discourse in Illinois.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure he wishes there weren't any room for this type of discourse because he doesn't want to be held accountable for the legislation that he signed. He doesn't want to be held accountable for calling 100 of 102 county state's attorneys who opposed that legislation to release criminals, calling them fearmongers and liars, which is what he said at the bill signing more than a year ago.
Mm-hmm. But you're on WBBM radio. Craig Delamore, you did talk to him, and he did play that audio, and I thought he did a good job with that story. And then also, NBC5's Marian Ahern did a story on you. But what Craig Delamore...
Everywhere.
What's everywhere?
Because why? I mean, this just tells you what the press corps is interested in. You may be interested in public safety. They're interested in some politician, particularly on the left, calling somebody else, particularly on the right, a racist. That's it.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. But one thing that they missed about the story, just if we can listen to Mayor Lightfoot again, just listen to what she said. I'll stop it after she says it.
It darkens my skin. I don't think there's any dispute that I'm African-American. I'm black, and I'm very proud of that. So why do you need to blacken what I look like to send this ad out to suburban communities? So that in and of itself would be offensive enough. But what it's doing is it's fear-mongering. It doesn't recognize the fact that, in fact, we are down 18% in homicides. We are down 18% in shootings. And it shows black men I don't know where from. I don't even know if they're from Chicago, who are violent and looting.
Not Craig Delamore nor Marion Ahern picked up on the fact that she's denying that the video you use in your ad is from Chicago.
Well, she does. She said she doesn't know.
It's from their own news station. I'm a news local news junkie. I'm a nerd about it. Okay, and all the footage that I saw, I have seen before. Where? On local news. I mean, did she think you ripped off something from Philly or New York? I think that's a big component to this story too, because she's denying what's actually happening, and that is the violence in Chicago is at an all-time high. I don't care what she says. Yeah, homicides might be down, but carjackings are up 62%. But that is happening, and they're ignoring it. And with the Safety Act that's going to go into effect, it's going to get worse, folks.
Yeah, I mean, the footage, as I mentioned yesterday, has been widely seen. It's the culinary student getting shot in Lincoln Park. I mean, you would think you would know about these high-profile stories. It's the
carjacking on Michigan Avenue where the guy put the car inside
the rioting, yeah, and the sucker punch on State Street during that rioting. I mean, one of the weekend evenings where State Street between Illinois and Hubbard is just up for grabs. So, okay, but, you know, she's from Ohio. She's still learning the city. Oh, okay. So we'll give her a break.
But that was my point of contention with, you know.
Well, the whole everything, every single thing she said is wrong. There's not a single thing she said. And the press coverage, of course, just focuses on the split screen of the image from
April 19th.
The image from the City Club speech versus the image in the TV spot in the ad. We're going to talk to LaShawn Ford, who's a black Democrat state rep from the West Side, bottom of the 8 o'clock hour. He has an interesting perspective. I talked to him after the show yesterday a little bit about it. You'll want to hear his perspective on it, so I'll just leave that there for now. But fear-mongering the suburbs, first of all, the ad's running statewide. Secondly, you have a problem with suburbanites wanting to come downtown that has nothing to do and precedes this ad. The word is out about what's happening in Chicago. So she can make this about the suburbs as much as she wants. Additionally, this idea that it's like, oh, it's black people committing crime. By the way, one of the other images is of the man and woman, this couple that was murdered at the Puerto Rican Day parades. There's a Puerto Rican flag out of the car. That was one of the more graphic and horrific acts of violence we've seen in the last couple of years. And so, I mean, and as I said yesterday, I'm sorry, who are the supermajority of victims in all of this violent crime?
Black people.
Mostly black,
yeah.
Overwhelmingly black and Latino. So speaking out for the victims of violent crime because you don't agree with the lawlessness that has been engendered by the decisions made by the political ruling class in the city, that's racist. But not protecting those individuals, that's not racist. Or that's not problematic. The real problem is calling attention to violent predators of one race, although that's not. I mean, you know, violent predators, talking about black or Latinos who commit crime, whites who commit crime, it doesn't matter. This has nothing to do with it. Calling attention to violent predators, that's a problem. Calling attention to and pleading for victims of violent crime and more victims to come, that's a problem. All of that needs to be set aside so that we can just focus on dog whistles. And what you have is a mayor who's, you know, dog whistling dog whistles. Of course, because what else do they have to say? Something else, too, just on this topic. You know, there are two stations that are refusing to run the ads. But they're otherwise everywhere, including on digital platforms like Hulu and so forth.
I saw it on E yesterday.
So you have WGN and WLS that are refusing to run the ads.
And what are they saying? Why are they
the violence? There's, you know, this ad and all the ads, especially when you're spending the kind of money that I'm spending. I mean, you're dealing with general managers or corporate for network affiliates. You have to talk to corporate attorneys if there's any pushback on any of the content and so on and so forth. And you got a couple people at these stations, particularly ABC, who's running interference for the left. I'll tell you that right now. Their corporate attorney in New York is absurd. But anyway, not a single station, not a single platform mention anything about Lightfoot and this. It's all about violence. Oh, can we don't want to air. I mean, I mentioned this before, but we don't want to air, you know, it's just too violent. It's news footage from your network news programs
from
your affiliate news programs. This is stuff that it's okay to put on at 4:30 and 5 o'clock and 10 o'clock, but it's not okay to put in the context of an ad. Well, that's produced, and that doesn't have the context that we have in the news reports. Well, what does that matter? What does that matter?
I don't want young kids to see. Well, guess what? Young kids are getting shot every day. Four were shot yesterday outside of Shurs High School. My God, two are still in critical condition.
Summer of joy, but let's focus on
eating ice cream.
Let's focus on the pigmentation of Lori Lightfoot's skin in an ad. And again, and it was interesting because I did this interview for ABC7. The photog there is like, yeah, we looked at that. We saw what it was. It's what I said yesterday and what I said to Delamore on BBM too. It's the graphics package. I said, you know, I'm sorry I didn't use pastels with flowers and birds chirping. We're talking about violent crime. You're seeing people being attacked and murdered in some cases, part of the footage of those horrific crimes. So you use a dark graphics package because it's ominous. I mean, this is not like high level stuff here. And he's like, yeah, I see it because you look at the opening and like everything, you know, her clothes, the background, everything is slightly darker because it's the underlaid graphics package. And then Delamore asked me, and I like Craig.
I do too.
Delamore asked me, well, you know, didn't you like think about this, take a look at this, make sure that, you know, the sensitivity. First of all, I don't even know what the sensitivity is. Secondly, it never
occurred to you.
Never even thought about it. It never occurred to anyone that we work with, including the creative professionals. You know, I write the ads. I don't put all the bells and whistles together myself. Never occurred to anyone because that's not who we are. But this is who they are. This is who Lori Lightfoot and J.B. Pritzker are. They are two of the worst, most cynical people in the world who will stoke racial hatred as much as they can because they think it benefits them politically. And frankly, particularly for Lightfoot, that's her only path back to office.
I loved what the Republican ad strategist, Fred Davis, at least Marian Ahern, she reached out to him.
If you look at 90% of the ads out there in politics today, you looked at the original and what actually goes on the air, the color correction and vignetting has taken place.
Of course. Yeah, Fred's a longtime professional. Of course that's right. And by the way, the whole suburbanite thing, just one more point on this, and we'll take a couple calls after Mike's newscast. But this whole, like, you black people in the city versus white people in the suburbs. Hello, triple threat. You know, maybe take a ride out to the burbs. DuPage, Will County are quarter to a fifth to a quarter minority. Lake County is a quarter minority. Suburban Cook and so on and so forth. Get the hell out of here. That's what I'm saying. It's just a naked, brazen race hustle. And we should be used to that by now and also sick of it by now.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy talking about the governor's race and the ad that has generated some controversy because it's been used to cry racism by Mayor Triple Threat and Governor Jellybelly and the rest of the flotsam and jetsam of the left. But I want to focus, which I've done in the campaign and did in interviews and do on this show, on the underlying point, you know, what's actually important here. Yeah, the summer of joy. We're going to have to update these numbers. 1,186 shot, 213 murdered, just in the summer of joy, so starting June 21st.
And yesterday we had four teenagers shot, two are in critical condition. Outside of Shears High School, oh, now Mike's saying his one is in critical condition. That's great news. Doing something so innocent, eating ice cream on a patio outside of your high school right across the street.
Make that 1,190.
And then last night there was a fatal shooting in Little Village.
Make that 1,191 and 214 murdered. You know, this is a ticker.
Yeah.
But they want to talk about how they're presented on television. Okay. All right. I want to talk about the Safety Act. I want to talk about lawlessness. I want to talk about what prosecutors and sheriffs are saying throughout the state. That's who we should be listening to. And oh, by the way, real media outlets like CWB Chicago that are on the case. Number 29.
Oh, no.
Number 29 this year. You know, when I say number associated with the talking, the discussion of violent crime in Chicago, you know what it means. You should by now because of this multi-year series now that CWB Chicago has been doing, which gives you an indication of what's happening, what's coming to your community if the Safety Act isn't repealed, and you have to repeal the policymakers before you can repeal the policy. That's how it works. The 29th person, just in 2022, after 74 last year, 29th person this year accused of killing or shooting or attempting to kill or shoot someone in Chicago while on bail for a felony, an unrelated felony. The alleged crimes involve at least 63 victims, 13 of whom died. Last year it was 111. Do you think Lightfoot or Pritzker could recite these numbers to you? You think they're paying this close of attention? 63 victims, 13 whom died because habitual violent offenders were put back on the street by Kim Fox's office. And, you know, the Cook County Circuit Court judges. This is not a police matter. It's the other side of the house. Prosecution matter.
And some families who've lost loved ones in this manner, because the person who killed their loved one should have been in jail in the first place, have filed lawsuits. But it's only two families. More should come forward and hold them accountable.
Number 29, three-time convicted felon. Stopped into a man's Inglewood apartment around 4:30 p.m. on August 4th, pulled out a gun, pointed at the victim and his 43-year-old female roommate, demanded the property. Then he shot the man in the thigh, fled with his wallet, charged with Class X armed robbery with a firearm. Previously convicted of three violent crimes, armed robbery, aggravated battery. Now he's being held without bail.
Oh, that's nice.
And in the commercial in question, you'll note all the talk of the actual substance of the legislation, which is, of course, of no interest to the Chicago Press Corps, and the list of the sorts of violent crimes for which criminals, alleged criminals, and repeat convicted criminals will be turned back out on the street because you can't use past bad acts against them when it comes to any sort of exception to the no cash bail protocol that will be in place as of January 1. Talk aggravated battery, arson, kidnapping. There was a Good Samaritan, another story in the Summer of Joy. Good Samaritan helps woman escape early morning attempted abduction in the West Loop. West Loop is, you know, these are one of the areas where there's a lot of young people because of the Google and the high-end restaurants and bars and so forth, the entertainment district that's been relatively safe compared to the other used-to-be-safe entertainment districts, but nothing is.
He was the dog walker, and he had some mace, and the guy was trying to kidnap her, and he went and sprayed the guy with mace and saved her life.
Here's another one, too, just another day in Chicago. Guy gets arrested at Rush Hospital, walks out of Chicago Police Station on his own recognizance, of course, and then gets arrested again in the Loop, same day.
So, oh, that's impressive.
Yeah.
Hey. Go Chicago. Mm-hmm.
He pushed a dude off the platform at the Illinois Medical District Blue Line.
Oh, that's a new thing to do now, by the way.
Uh-huh.
Just throw him in from an oncoming train.
So do you want to talk about this stuff? You want to talk about a city where, you know, your kid graduates from college, if they do get a job in Chicago, and come down here in the big city and enjoy their 20s in the big city for a while, and how you feel about that? You know, the pied a terre that you're going to buy in the city if you live in the suburbs to come down for the weekends to take in shows and enjoy, you know, good meals and so forth. Is that still happening? And again, this is not something that is particularly unique to Chicago residents. So the bad actors in the suburbs, and there are a lot of them. I mean, it's always a small percentage of the population, we know, that are responsible for most of the violent crime. But there is violent crime that occurs in the suburbs. And if you tell those that are inclined to do harm to others that there are virtually no consequences to it, they will respond accordingly, just as we've seen from that same profile of person in the city. It's no different. I don't know why you think it is. There's nothing special. There's no force field or imaginary line that keeps people out of the suburbs who mean to do harm to others. We've seen sophisticated home burglary operations in the suburbs. We've seen carjackings in the suburbs. Yeah. We've seen people that come out from the city on Metra or the L to steal cars. You know, sometimes they're going to run into somebody, and sometimes that's going to end violently one way or the other. So, again, if you want to make physical safety a racial issue, if you want to be a cheap demagogue like Triple Threat or Jelly Belly, go ahead. If you think that's going to make you safer, you think that's going to, you know, teach somebody a lesson, these are all just self-inflicted wounds. And maybe this time, Chicago and Illinois will decide this is one self-inflicted wound too many. We'll see.
Governor Pritzker saying Darren Bailey should immediately demand that his allies take this ad off the air.
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. this is like, you know, have you seen this act before?
Yes.
I mean, it's
the official statement. I'm just letting you know.
You have the contrived race hustle that follows with the performative moral indignation. It's all part. I mean, this is just all part. These are the component parts of the identitarian hustle.
Yeah, but Darren Bailey, I thought he had a great response. His campaign said, "We have no communication or control over this PAC, but Pritzker and Lightfoot have control over the skyrocketing crime in Chicago."
Richard, South Suburbs.
Yeah, hey, Dan. You win the Lori Lightfoot bronze medal. The gold medal went to Donald Trump, F. Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Silver medal, Clarence Thomas, F. Clarence Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
Now you get the bronze because the only thing missing was F. Dan Proft.
Well, the week is not over. So, you know, we'll see. Thanks for the call, Richard. Michael Southside.
Morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. Thank you for taking my call. As far as I'm concerned, Lori Lightfoot, Dan, did you a huge favor. Not only did she further expose herself as a cynical race hustler who doesn't care for a significant portion of voters here in Illinois, but she also further publicized the Safety Act. So as far as I'm concerned, it's a big win for you.
I completely agree. Thanks for the call, Michael. I'm happy. I like when people show you who they are, and I hope people understand it. I think most people do. And absolutely right. She created hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of paid media in earned media form. So I appreciate that, as do my donors. If people are wondering, because I got some text and stuff. This stuff, I mean, first of all, this is eminently predictable. So it comes as no surprise to me what she's done, what Pritzker's doing. And it doesn't bother me one iota. I know who these people are, the Pritzkers and the Lightfoots of the world. I know who the Chicago media is. This is unsurprising. And again, my only interest is in mission of taking J.B. Pritzker out of office, and maybe helping to take Lori Lightfoot out of office, too. We'll see how that race develops. But my interest is in changing the power structure in this state and beyond the state, but just focus on this state. That's my only interest. And so all of the histrionics of the left, the scams upon scams that they run, the name calling, doesn't bother me at all and doesn't discourage me at all. In fact, it emboldens me. And I think it emboldens a lot of people, too, that are sick of this and they see right through it. Rich in Indian Head Park.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. What amazes me about Mayor Lightfoot is every time she's criticized, she always goes back to saying it's because I'm black or it's because I'm a woman. Isn't it a fact? The reason she's criticized is because her policies on crime are terrible, along with the governor's. They have terrible policies. These people commit crimes, and they're back out on the street in a matter of minutes. She doesn't make any sense at all, and she hides behind being black and that people are racist against her.
Yeah.
Thanks, and have a good day.
Thanks, Rich.
You know what? I got to find out, too, because we have such a lack of police in the city and that she's using 70 police officers. I have to find out whether or not that's true.
Paul Vallis, remember Paul Vallis? Gets somebody, oh, another white guy wants to tell me what to do. Yeah. Oh, is that who Paul Vallis is?
And then when somebody else decided to jump in, oh, it's the silly season.
No. But the
oh,
white,
yeah, the white thing.
Paul Vallis is just a white guy who wants to tell me what to do or something like this.
Yeah, we have that.
I mean, does that stuff ever, do you ever say, not only is that unfair and untrue, but I'm going to punish you for appealing to the lowest common denominator.
What she said was another day, another white man who's trying to take away my job. That's what she said.
And whatever. Yeah. Six of one. Yeah. You get the point. I mean, honestly, who buys this stuff? I mean, other than, ooh, the Chardonnay Antifa in Hinsdale. Ron and Carol Stream.
More than Amy. I was just thinking, the way Lightfoot and Pritzker come at you about your PAC ads. As far as I'm concerned, they don't get to say a word about it unless they're willing to come on and debate you. Otherwise, shut up, idiots. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for the call, Ron. I wish they would. I mean, what the disposition of this show has been from the beginning, which is, anybody from the left that wants to come on, we try and get them on all the time, including, obviously, the elected officials here. And few will come on. But yeah, Lightfoot, Pritzker, any time, any day, all morning. We'd do 4 hours. I'd love it. What do they say?
No.
Crickets. No, crickets. That should also tell you something. Oh, we're happy to debate these issues. No, you're not. You're not happy to debate any issues. You don't want to debate anything. You'll do the bare minimum to give the appearance that you're willing to engage or say something important to the public on issues that they actually care about. But it's just the bare minimum. It's all just ceremonial.
Right, like the debate that Pritzker is going to have with Darren Bailey, because he has to have one. He doesn't want to. He doesn't want to debate the issues. Anyway, he's busy campaigning for president.
Yeah, just he'll two-step, try to two-step his way for an hour through some, you know, prosaic questions that some
boring,
you know, room temperature IQ'd member of the Chicago Press Corps will ask. And then, you know, say, look, I debated.
I did it. I did my
best. We won. They won. Blah, blah, blah.
Remember,
be lost in the wash.
When he took my press credential away, he took all of our press credentials away because they don't want pushback at all. They can't handle it. They don't even want to look at it in the room. We got, you know, like as soon as like, we got to get a, find a way to get that out. And that is all of us.
Yeah, maybe, you know, so we, this is like an opportunity to use their their mindless rhetoric against them. I don't feel seen. I don't feel heard. We need to make sure people feel seen and heard. People feel seen and people feel heard. Mayor, governor, I don't feel seen. I don't feel heard. I know this is very important to you.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, before we get to the student loan announcement from Mr. 10%, the big guy yesterday, NBC5 coverage, the NBC5 coverage of my ad was a political ad. And I think when they cut me in.
Yeah, because there's like a, so they show a picture of Lightfoot and then you swoop in on the side and it's a picture of you dressed in a suit. I think you look very fetching.
Yeah.
Is that your high school senior year picture or when you ran for governor?
I think they lightened my skin. So we got a problem now with NBC5. I'm accusing them of lightening my skin.
No, but it did look like a political ad. But that's how packages look these days, news packages. But at least, you know, she interviewed Fred Davis. I think that was great. And then she interviewed Delmarie Cobb. And
Yeah.
I know. I thought she did a very good job.
All right, moving on here. The big announcement yesterday from the big guy on student debt.
Education is a ticket to a better life. It's something Jill and I, Kamala and Doug, we understand deeply. I'm sure the vast majority of you do as well. But over time, that ticket has become too expensive for too many Americans. All this means is an entire generation is now saddled with unsustainable debt in exchange for an attempt, at least, at a college degree. The burden is so heavy that even you may not have access to the middle-class life that the college degree once provided. Many people can't qualify for a mortgage to buy a home because of the debt they continue to carry. They carry it's too high, and they can't come up with the down payment anyway. A lot of folks are even putting off starting families because of the cost. And the dream of starting your own business is just way off in the distance with the debt that so many are saddled with. Many of you had to leave school because the financial strain was much too high. About a third of the borrowers have debt but no degree, and worst of both worlds, debt and no degree. The burden is especially heavy on Black and Hispanic borrowers, who on average have less family wealth to pay for it. They don't own their homes to borrow against to be able to pay for college.
I got an idea on the mortgage issue.
Yeah. What?
Mortgage debt forgiveness program for those people that have student debt, but that prevents them from getting eliminate the student debt, eliminate the mortgage debt too. So cancel $10,000 for borrowers making less than $125,000 a year, and $20,000 for those who receive Pell grants. Big Guys administration estimates 27 million Americans will be eligible for up to $20,000 in forgiveness, and some 20 million will see their balances erased completely.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. And what's it going to cost, about $300 billion? Maybe,
I think it's
give or take a few, because Susan Rice couldn't figure it out.
I think it's going to be bigger than that if you you include the 20 grand. Yeah, this was a good exchange. Susan Rice asked the question about whether this is, you know, the obvious one, whether this is unfair to people who took out loans and then, you know,
paid them off.
Right.
You know, like most of us responsible Americans.
Yeah, we used to do back in the olden days when you take out a loan, you pay off the loan, but that's no longer the case. Here's what Susan Rice, domestic policy advisor, had to say.
First of all, Republicans didn't complain when certain small businesses during the pandemic got extraordinary financial relief and without having to pay back those loans. But when some businesses needed it and other businesses didn't need it, this is the same principle. We have a country where we all benefit, where the middle and working class are doing well.
No, that is not the same principle. That is not the same principle at all. Because the PPP money was provided because the government shut down businesses, shut down the economy.
Yes.
So, you know, whether businesses took it that could have survived or not, you still did damage to that business. So you owe compensation. Please familiarize yourself with the Constitution, domestic policy advisor Rice. No one has done damage to the government. The state has not done damage to these college grads or not college grads who've racked up student loan debt. That was a choice they voluntarily made. No one imposed this on them the way that the shutdown of people's businesses was imposed upon them. So that falls completely flat. But hey, for those of you who paid off your student loans, you get an attaboy from Susan Rice.
That's to their credit. But that doesn't mean that those who are, for whatever reason, unable to pay back their loans, like, you know, one third of people have debt and no college degree. That doesn't mean that because some were able to do so, nobody should help those who weren't. By that logic, we wouldn't help anybody in this country.
How much will this cost? How much will Americans have to pay on this price tag overall?
Well, that remains to be determined, and it will be a function of what percentage of eligible borrowers actually take up this opportunity.
$300 billion?
We'll see what, when they take up the opportunity, we'll be able to give you a much better sense of that.
I mean, they don't even know. That's how far their head is up there, you know what.
As if it mattered. As if it mattered.
But isn't this shifting, you know, the burden to the well-off, the 87% who chose not to go to college? Because eventually,
87%.
How many people in America didn't go to college?
About two-thirds.
Two-thirds. All right. So, but we're going to have to pay for this, because somebody's going to pay for this. Money doesn't just magically appear, people. I hate to tell you that.
I'm glad that you asked, because KJP, Corinne Jean-Pierre, the quadruple threat, she was so unfortunate for her, tasked with trying to explain something that she just completely does not understand.
Is this like watching a horror film?
Here's what she said in response to Steve Ducey's questions about things like, how does this get paid for? You know, those questions out of left field that no one could anticipate. Oh, boy.
What we are saying is the work that this administration has done, the work that the Democrats in Congress has done, is actually there. And you see that the $1.7 trillion deficit deduction that you see is going to benefit us in being able to do something for the middle class, This is about doing something for people who make less than $125,000, $1.7 trillion. That's what we've been able to do.
But when you forgive,
By the way, if you and your wife each make $124,000, is $248,000 household income, is that middle income?
Yeah, that's not where I'm from.
I mean, you know, you may not pierce the top 5%, but you're going to be close.
You're doing well.
If you're, you know, in the top 10%, I don't know how 10% has become the middle, but I digress. Unfortunately.
Oh, no. Did it continue?
Well, yeah. So they're doing something for the middle class. They did the work so they can do something for the middle class. Doing something for the middle class. $1.7 trillion, other numbers, blah, blah, blah. And then. They're also smart and effective. You know how you know? Because she says so.
Debt. You're not just disappearing debt. So who is paying for this?
And then I'll give you the second part. We lifted the pause, right? We're going to lift the pause at the end of this year, which is going to matter, right? Which is going to offset a lot of what we're doing as well. When you think about the $4 billion that's going to go back into as revenue back into this process of folks paying right their college tuition, that matters as well. So we are doing this in a smart way. We are doing this in a way that's going to be effective. We are doing in this a way that keeps to the president's promise on giving people who need some breathing room, I just laid out for you, Peter, how we're seeing this process and why this matters. Again, I just laid out because of the work that we have done.
That is especially true when it comes to the climate crisis, which is why we will work together and continue to work together to address these issues, to tackle these challenges, and to work together as we continue to work operating from the new norms, rules, and agreements that we will convene to work together on to galvanize global action. With that, I thank you all.
Yeah.
Oh,
they're doing the work.
We're doing the work together.
They do the work every single day. That's what they do. Karine Jean-Pierre is a proud graduate of the Kamala Harris School of Communications, as you heard. A point of order. I know she had
that
to...
I'm sweating.
She had
that.
To stop talking because Steve Ducey just asking a simple question about how does this get paid for was...
too much.
Befuddling for her. $1.7 trillion, something about $4 billion. Oh, so let me understand something. You're going to pay for wiping away $300 to $500 billion in student loan debt by having people who don't qualify for the zeroing out of their student debt or the $10,000 and $20,000 just continuing to make installment payments on their loans. How does that work? How does people who make installment payments on their loan underwrite $500 million of debt that you're just writing off? I mean, I'm not a professional banker. I'm not a CFO or anything, but maybe somebody could help me understand what Karine Jean-Pierre is talking about.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Ralph and Rantoul.
Hi, good morning. You know, there's so much in these clips, it's hard to unpack, but, you know, I think that the program should be named appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
It should be called the Love Your Neighbor Program,
mm-hmm.
because I want to personally pick the people that I would like to offload my debt on so that they would know that I'm loving them. And it doesn't go far enough. I want reparations for past debt that I've already paid.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And to top it all off, Dan and Amy, the reason that climate is so important is that so much of the world we live in is outside and not inside.
Yeah, it's such a great point, Ralph. You should think about maybe getting a professorship at the Kamala Harris School of Communications. Thanks for the call.
I mean, it's such pandering, and it's such a way to try and get the young college kids or those who just graduated to become Democrats. Join the party. Like, hey, what free ride? Why not?
Well, there's a lot of Democrats who paid off their student loans, too. I wonder how they feel about it. The ability to pick the people that are going to pay down your debt.
That's true.
Because, you know, maybe you get like a – maybe they give you like certificates. Like, you know, like I paid down Dan Prof's student loan debt, and you can frame that and put it up on your – yeah, it's like adopting a
– adopting a highway or adopting, you know.
Well, adopting a college scofflaw of sorts.
Look at the headline right now on WGN. College loan website crashes.
Sure.
And I know a person
to get my debt wiped away.
Her son's a junior in college, and she said that they didn't take out loans, but he did call the FA office to sign up for the free cash.
Maybe we can get Sally Struthers to market this program of adopting a debt-laden college kid and paying off their student debt.
I'm going to have to pay more, you know, inflation. What should they call it? The Inflation Expansion Act? That's what they should call it.
I like Ralph's Love Your Neighbors Act. I think that's where this is, because this is what every issue is. It's between those who love on the left and those who hate on the right. Mm-hmm. That's every issue. Every single issue comes down to that. The lovers of the on the left and the haters on the right. At least for those, you know, that have a kindergarten understanding of the world. Denise in Ingleside, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and it's great to be on your show.
Great to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Dan, I saw you last year at the cigar thing with Dennis and Sean Thompson. It was great to meet you.
Yeah.
Saw you at the end.
But
the reason why this sparks an interest, this all started under Obama, when Obama took the loans away from the banks, the student loans. Mm-hmm. And now the government got involved, and now there are no limits or caps on tuition. And again, another opportunity to pull away money from the American taxpayer and give it away to the people that don't want to pay their loans.
Thanks for the call, Denise. Appreciate it. Larry and Bartlett.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, I think you were wrong. Ralph doesn't have a prayer of getting to be a professor. He has far too much common sense.
Yeah.
Comment I wanted to make was I did some taxes for some family members a couple of years ago, and one of the things we discovered, one of my family members had a $7,000 debt forgiven. Well, the very next thing that happened is that forgiven $7,000 became part of income according to the IRS, so they had to pay tax on it.
Yep. That's such a great point.
I don't know. I mean, since this is being done extra legally, thanks for the call, Larry. Like, you know, sort of like Obama with the DACA program. I know what I'm doing is illegal, but we're going to do it anyway. He doesn't have the authority to do this. Biden does not have the authority to do this by himself. This should have to go through Congress. It's not saying it will, but it should. And so if it does, we'll see. But I assume somebody there will be on the stick and say this is tax-free.
According to CNBC, it's estimated that each taxpayer will be slapped with an extra $2,000.
You can't put a price on love. Tony on the South Side.
Good morning. Good morning, Dan and Amy, my Lammy Land. So, hey, listen, after listening to you guys yesterday doing the good work on AM560, I was at work, and then I started listening to Working Man by Rush. Then I decided maybe I should listen to Working Man. Maybe I should listen to Working for the Weekend, but I'm not really too keen on that song. So I decided maybe I'll just listen to, you know, Works Hard for the Money. I was putting in the good work yesterday myself, but you know something, dude? This is too much of a workout. I'm done. I can't do this.
Wow, that's good. Nice range, Tony. Thanks for the call. Well, you got a Donna Summer in there. You got a lover boy. Work. You got a rush. Did he get a men at work in there too?
Yeah.
John in Naperville.
Yeah, you know, this is going to end up going to Congress, and it's going to be an issue for the upcoming elections in November. Just wait and see. You know, the big two things I got is how come the House isn't bringing all these, so-called professors and the presidents of these big institutions before Congress to explain why your institution costs so much. And why is financial aid tied to the parents' income?
Right.
If an 18-year-old could go off to war and do all these other things and vote, why does their financial aid package depend on how much money I make? That makes no sense.
Thanks for the call, John.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. A fun column from our friend Dan Henninger over at the Wall Street Journal about Tuesday's primary results in New York State.
New York State?
Where Mr. Sardonicus, Jerry Nadler.
The little man. How tall is he? Is he a munchkin?
His waist is 54. His inseam is 16. He's a physical impossibility is what he is.
But he got the stomach, the lap band on, so he has lost.
Yeah, he looks great.
Hot. Oh, he's fetching. Just gorgeous.
So,
that's a man I want to,
The Dems in New York, Dem Socialists there, they try to, gerrymander the map as much as possible, like every political party does in every state when they have control. But they ran afoul of the law, and they got their map thrown out, and that got Carolyn Maloney, another incumbent, thrown in with Mr. Sardonicus, Jerry Nadler. So they had to run off. They had to, run against each other to, multi-decade fixtures in the congressional delegation from New York.
And Nadler won, he handedly over her.
Yeah, Henninger's headline, Jerry Nadler beats Carolyn Maloney in East Germany's primary. Yeah, that's about right. But there's some instruction for Chicago here in the results and this commentary from Henninger. The campaign was something out of Monty Python, writes Henninger, with Maloney pushing her pro-abortion credentials by saying you cannot send a man to do a woman's job. Nadler ran as Donald Trump's impeachment tormentor. And this, you remember, even Trump did like a fake endorsement in the race, to skewer the both of them. It was great. New Yorkers could use a laugh talking about Trump's fake endorsement and comments on both candidates in the race. He described Jerry Nadler. If you know who he is, I'm sure most of our listeners do because they pay attention. But he described Jerry Nadler as high energy, sharp, quick witted, and bright. But he said Carolyn Maloney is the better man. Henninger race. New Yorkers could use a laugh. The grim East German analogy isn't so far fetched. New York is now a far left, one party state if measured by election outcomes. Though a city of more than 8 million, although that number is falling, almost no one bothers to vote. Turnout Tuesday was 8%.
What?
8%.
That's nothing.
This is why four Democratic Socialists in the city won their primaries for state Senate. And speaking of which, we had the same thing happen with aldermanic races over the last couple cycles with Democrat Socialists, avowed Socialists winning aldermanic seats. People aren't paying attention. Meet one of the victors that Henninger refers to. She is now New York Dem State Senate nominee, Kristen Gonzalez.
I know we're saving the speeches for a little later, but today we really proved that socialism wins. Across this city.
Yeah.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
They want to double down on the worst instincts of the establishment Dem socialists, if you will, versus the insurgent Dem socialists, those that have been pushed left but haven't occupied that space versus the true believers that are coming up like Miss Gonzalez. And, of course, what did New York do last year in the mayor's race? Well, they thought they were getting a law and order candidate in Eric Adams, former NYPD police. But that doesn't quite describe how it's turned out. Henninger writes, a series of recent crimes are a case study in the perils of one-party rule, especially when the party represents progressivism's see-no-evil ideology. And that is, that's exactly what the description of their philosophy as it pertains to public safety is. The subway cleaner brutally beaten after he intervened against a man harassing women. The news that that wasn't the news that he writes, that subway cleaner. The news was the head of the MTA and the subway workers union felt compelled to convene a press conference pleading with the Bronx district attorney to enforce a law that would ban the attacker from the subway for 3 years. The injured worker's sister said she hopes he gets the max, but we know he won't. The minimum is progressivism's goal. The minimum. That's a good comment, too. The next day, people were talking about this. You were talking about the right. other day, Amy. The guy who sucker punched another man that leaving him in a coma. Oh, initially charged with attempted murder.
Because it was attempted murder.
Then downgraded the Bronx prosecutors. You know, the same sort of no cash bail, decarceration, non-prosecution prosecutors we have here in Chicago, Cook County. At least with Fox, not necessarily the rank and file, but certainly with Fox and Lightfoot and Pritzker. Forthcoming state law, keep harping on it. Bronx prosecutors downgraded the charge. This guy's in a coma.
Yeah.
They downgraded the charge to misdemeanor assault.
And harassment. Oh, he was harassed right onto the ground and knocked unconscious, and he's in critical condition.
And so the guy walked.
Walked.
And then Hochul, the governor, intervened because she felt she needed to politically.
Yeah, because the people of New York and the media was pressuring her, like, how the hell can you let this happen?
Yeah.
And then she acted all valiant or heroic. I'd stop this. She ordered his rearrest.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing about that. Hochul has the power to actually fire district attorneys like DeSantis does. Did she do that? No.
No.
Because this is just a throwaway for short-term political reasons, because she's, you know, facing a stout challenge from Congressman Lee Zeldin in her election. The following day after that, guy knocked into a coma. Stories, just like the stories we tell in Chicago. Ghanaian taxi driver who chased five people fleeing their fare in Queens was beaten to death. He was the father of four. The crime caught on video. Another press conference was held. This one led to the head of the taxi drivers union saying, stop considering the rights of criminals above the rights of victims. In all of these public outpourings, writes Henninger, with the exception of the MTA chief, the members of the victims' families are the representatives of the unions and organizations speaking for them. A subway cleaner, a taxi cab driver. They want the max. And the representatives, the families, representatives of the union and organizations speaking for them are black or Hispanic. They want the max. Their pain has no resonance because progressive criminal justice theory has become an ideology of sudden death for minorities at their jobs or walking on the street. The cycle of crime, fear, and tears grinds the city down daily. Does that sound familiar? Mayor Adams has been complaining about the busloads of migrants Texas Governor Greg Abbott is sending to New York. A sanctuary city, Henninger asks, sanctuary from what? I guess from Mexican drug cartel violence. That's about the only thing that could be worse, I suppose. But, I mean, his description and what's going on in New York City Now, amplify that by about a factor of six, and that's what's happening in Chicago on a per capita basis. And who it's happening to. Same story. Same story in just about every big city, mid to big city in the country. All governed by see no evil progressives. Okay. And meanwhile, it's, you know, abortion on demand all the time. And this is where the left thinks their bread gets buttered on November 8th. Listen to this. I mean, you know, there is no such thing as over-the-top rhetoric when it comes to the left. There is no place they will not go. This is the new head of the Planned Parenthood ghouls. Her name is Alexis McGill Johnson. And she was on MSNBC talking about the $50 million that they're going to spend, Planned Parenthood is going to spend on the midterms, you know, to support pro-aborts.
Right.
$50 million. And yet, here again, failure of Republicans. Yet we still have federal tax dollars underwriting Planned Parenthood, who then use money, and money's fungible, use that money to underwrite pro-abort Democrats. What kind of sense does that make? First of all, on principle, they shouldn't be getting any money. And secondly, just on the politics of it, how cowardly can you be that you're willing to use other people's money, forcibly extracted, to underwrite your political opponents? I don't understand it. I do not understand it. And we have had the same thing going on in this state for years, including with Rauner, our last Republican, quotation marks, governor. Underwriting your political opponents, that makes sense. How? What benefit you expect to get? And don't tell me, they just believe. Yeah, they believe. Alexis McGill Johnson on the $50 million in the midterms.
I actually think, as my colleague at NARAL, Manita Timurajah, likes to say, abortion is actually going to save democracy. Because if we can go state by state and we can actually transform the way in which people understand not just what it means to fight for abortion access, but what it means to actually transform how we vote in each state and vote locally to ensure that protection.
There's just no end to the violence perpetrated by the left, is there? Talk about government from womb to tomb. How about violence from womb to tomb? Gary in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, thanks, Dan. I appreciate all these things you talk about. I just wanted to share some information that actually got out of your show some time ago before the primary. I know an analysis that somebody on your show was saying on how they were kind of confused why more people seem to be voting in the Republican primaries in states like Illinois. And it's actually a long-term plan, very wise plan of the Democrats, where they have control over their seats, and they tell their key people, their unions, say, vote in the Republican primary for our candidate in the Republican primary. That's how they took over DuPage County and Illinois. I'm sure that that's how they're doing it in New York. And it's basically been about the money. These people in office on the quote-unquote Republican side, their key is just to have their office insured so they don't want to be attacked by the press. They want to go along, and they fund the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. No, right. Thanks for the call. That's what happens in a kleptocracy. It's not about policy. It's about protecting fiefdoms. It's non-aggression pacts. It's, you know, I do for you if you do for me. You know, whatever happens, we protect each other. So we continue to enjoy our sinecures and the benefits that they throw off. That's absolutely true. And you're right, too, about the idea that, you know, low turnout is great for any sort of establishment because you can get something close to a controlled vote. Sure. Right. We know, this is how the machine worked for generations in Chicago and elsewhere. Absolutely. Tom in Oswego.
Hey, good morning, Danny and Amy. I've been saying this for years, that the thing that disappoints me the most are the voters. The politicians, we know who they are, Republican or Democrat. We know what they'll do. But for some reason, they keep voting the worst people in.
I'm at a point now where I have a few people who are Democrats. I can't even talk to them and or understand how you could vote for these people. And then, and Amy, I just wonder if we're at a tip, you know, I always say a tipping point, but I think we are. We're at a point now where I don't know if we can even go back. There's so many people misinformed in this country. We've become a Facebook country where everybody is, all their knowledge is based on Twitter and Facebook and these, you know, 30-second ads that these politicians put out, knowing that people are so uninformed that that's what they're going to base their vote on. Well, I don't honestly know how we go back.
Well, before we go back, thanks for the call, Tom. I think we need to take Confucian instruction: when in hole, stop digging. If we could, you know, let's cease the destructive behavior for just a minute, take a breath, and maybe we can figure out a way, start thinking about ways to climb out of the holes that we've dug ourselves into. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Yeah, we've become the Eloy. That's the problem from the time machine. Penninger, I think, is a little off with his description. It's not see no evil. The Democrats deliberately inflict evil, whether it's the decay of the urban centers, whether it's turning the higher education system into a racketeering enterprise with their student loan forgiveness, whether it's the stuff that's going on, they give away all this money to Ukraine. They're inflicting evil deliberately. It's one big middle finger to the American people every single week. I'm reading this great book now called The Great Cities in History by John Julius Norwich. Little snippets, 5-6 pages on like Damascus, Athens, Carthage, Rome, throughout the whole world, throughout all history. It's inspired me, everything that's going on. I think I'm going to write a book called The Great U.S. Cities, Our History. Is there a U.S. city? Is there a U.S. city that you would really want to go to anymore? I mean, Seattle? Do you want to go to Seattle?
I'm done.
L.A.?
No.
San Fran?
No.
New Orleans? New Orleans carjacking is our way up there. Chicago? Detroit? New York? I wouldn't go to New York anymore. I might go to Boston. I might go to San Diego. San Antonio?
San Diego's dirty.
I don't know. So I'm going to try and get little snippets together on each one and get that book project going.
All right, very good. I'll look for that. Have you been working on your Darren Bailey impersonation at all?
Just a little bit last night.
All right.
Get us... fire, J.B. Pritzker. Chicago is becoming a hellhole. I work on a little more. I'm a farmer. I'm a downstate farmer. We need a farmer in the governor's office. Yeah. I could be the Illinoisan Cincinnatus. I could bring and give the government back to the people. I need some work.
It's getting there. Though. Yeah, you got to practice. I get
standard
it.
Lines, too, you have memorized.
How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice.
There you go. Yeah.
Thanks, Frank.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. There's a interview that Barton Swaim over at the Journal did of one of America's great historians, James Hankins from Harvard, that I've been meaning to get to all week. So let's get to it here, shall we? He recently read, and now I'm reading, Barton Swaim did, Hankins' book Virtue Politics, which was a study of Renaissance Italy and the Italian humanist thinkers. For Petrarch and his followers, constitutional form was far less important than the character of rulers. Character of rulers. And this is, you know, all with an eye towards putting 2022 America in some kind of context. The Italian humanist aimed primarily to bring rulers who were good and wise. Constitutional thought aimed primarily to limit the damage that might be done by bad and foolish rulers. This is the way, frankly, our founding fathers were educated, George Washington among them. The Renaissance humanists didn't think of the way to reform a society is through laws and institutions, create new agencies, put together a few blue ribbon commissions. No, it meant you understood the true potential of human nature to be good, to achieve true nobility as opposed to inherited nobility. But you also understood the man was fallen. And of course, the early connection to Christianity informs their thinking. Hankins calls what the humanists proposed political meritocracy, which is to mean a society, not to mean a society run by the credentialed elite. What the humanists envisioned was ruled by the wisest, most virtuous people. And he distinguishes that from the virtue signalers of our day, those with the love is love and hate has no home here signs in their yards.
Can't see those enough.
Hankins describes those people as they're enjoying the approval of their own consciences without training their minds in any serious way through moral effort. Yeah, it's a generous way of putting it. For the humanists, the good and wise ruler was able to draw on his skills and language to persuade people to act for the common good. The humanists were opposed to the scholastic idea you could argue someone into good behavior. They thought you needed the whole person. You had to engage the passions and appetite, and precision of language and eloquence in the service of nobility was required. So it's an interesting perspective on that era, because as we see confidence in our institutions dropping like a stone and elites being unmasked as not being particularly wise or judicious with the power to which they've been entrusted, what do we do? Hankins does offer a note of encouragement, because he still teaches there. He's been teaching in Harvard for almost 40 years. The younger generation out there is disgusted with the older one. The people who get all the attention from the press are the woke, but there's another big part of the young population that's ready for a moral revolution. Well, that's probably what it's going to take. And that's good to hear, particularly in comparison to what we heard from that state Senate, the Dem state Senate nominee in New York. Talking about it.
Socialism is alive.
Last hour, yeah. Celebrating socialism, and they're not going to stop till socialism is the order of the day in New York City. It isn't now. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Richard Vedder. He's a professor emeritus of economics at Ohio U, the Bobcats, senior fellow at the Independent Institute, and author of Restoring the Promise, Higher Education in America. Professor Vedder, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be with you, Dan and Amy.
So I know you penned this piece about whether or not the U.S. can be exceptional again and what the hurdles are. But before we get into some of the particulars you identified, what about what Hankins is saying about the need, essentially the need for more revolution? And he's somewhat optimistic about the generation of students he's currently teaching. But is that where do we have to get back to a fundamental understanding of the fallenness of man, the limits that should be imposed on governmental power, and the sorts of people that we want to wield limited power around a civilized society?
Absolutely. This is the first time I've been doing radio. I've been doing these things for decades. This is the first time I've listened to a drive time a radio show talking about 15th century Renaissance history.
We're a little different over here. Yeah, Chicago.
Yeah, no, I think it's super cool. And I think Hankinson's exactly right. I had a chance to go to Harvard when I was, but I went to Northwestern instead. So I stayed in the Chicago area. We taught good stuff in those days, Western civilization and so forth, at all throughout America. And people in high schools and so forth were learning. They're learning the basics about our system, about free enterprise, about the rule of law, et cetera, et cetera, as well as some religious training as well in many cases. And we have backed off that so much, and it has declined. And as one who's taught for 55 years myself, I've seen it personally.
And you know, sorry to interrupt, but this is not an abstraction either. This is not some, you know, 400-level discussion. This, first of all, Hankin's book is accessible, number one. His writing is very accessible. And number two, I mean, what we're really talking about is what should we be talking about in K through, well, pre-K through post-secondary classrooms? And it's thing, at least as part of the discussion, should be, you know, the musings of James Hankins and others and raising these issues. So it's a very real and topical discussion.
Exactly. And we should be talking about John Locke, and we should be talking about Adam Smith and some of the great names of the past. Too many people today think that all wisdom in the world was created in the last 10 or 20 years during their lifetime. And they are abysmally ignorant of our history, our past, and how we got to where we are. And this is, don't get me going on that. I'll never stop. But that therein lies a serious problem.
Yeah, but how can U.S. become exceptional again? Where should we start?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, you know, being an old guy, I grew up in the mid part of the last century, the 50s and the 60s and so forth. And, you know, at that time, we were the world's leading power. There was no one even close to us. We had the highest GDP. We had the best universities and schools. We had it all, and we were the saviors of the world. We had saved Europe after World War II, the Marshall Plan. We were benevolent victors in war, and we had a moral standing that was high, as well as an economic standing. And a lot of things have happened in the last half century. In a piece I had in the Wall Street Journal last week, I named five things that are going on that I think are part of the reasons we've declined, and there are probably others. We don't work as hard, for example. Just pick one. Just go back to the beginning of this century, the first month of this century, January 2000. 65%, I'm rounding these numbers off, 65% of adult Americans worked. Now only 60% work. You say, no big deal, 65 to 60. Well, that has meant a loss of millions of jobs, 12 million jobs. We would have 12 million more working if we were working at the same level we were at the beginning of the century. That's all these shortage problems we're talking about, you know, these days. You can't get baby formula and so forth. Those problems would have been enormously reduced. So we have less work ethic. Fiscal responsibility has gone out the window since the year 2000, 2001. We have not had a single budget surplus in the federal budget. That is, we can't even pay our bills. The richest nation in the world, prosperous nation, 4% unemployment, we're running huge budget deficits. The respect for the law has declined, as we all know. We all know about all the riots and demonstrations and whatnot have gone on, and an upsurge in crime. You see it in Chicago very dramatically. We have a decline in the respect for free markets. You were talking about this at the beginning, Dan. You know, we're going to go to a socialist paradise, and a lot of young people seem to be buying into that. We have a rise in ignorance in our country. People, Americans who are, say, 15 years old, teenage Americans in the middle of high school, they're tested every 4 years by internationally on reading, science and on math in a program called the Program for International Student Assessment. The U.S. students do much poorer than the Asian students, of course, in China or Japan or South Korea, but even they don't do as well as the students in Britain. They don't do as well as the students in Germany. They don't as well as little countries, Estonia, Finland, countries like that. So we are sort of mediocre in our education results now. We used to be very high. So we have lost a lot of it. And so this is a serious problem.
So, yeah, and I mean, all those challenges to becoming exceptional again seem, you know, but I mean, the ignorance, the shiftlessness, the profligacy, I mean, they all go to the sort of the character formation piece. And so I wonder if we say, you know, the moral imperative right now is for this moral revolution that Hankins is talking about, but also something that Dennis Prager brought up recently when he was in town for an event with us, said the thing that you could do the most to change the future for your kids, for your family, and for the country is if your kids are in government schools right now, take them out. I mean, should that just, should that be a movement?
I'm a strong believer in non-government schools, alternative schools. I'm a believer in as an economist, I'm a great believer in competition. We have monopolies in most educational settings in the United States, where you have a monopoly government school. Of course, that's bad. And you mentioned, you hinted at another thing, Dan, and I didn't mention this, and I should have at the beginning. Church membership in the United States has dramatically declined. 70% of Americans in 1999, that's just 23 years ago, 70% of Americans said they belonged to a church, that they had membership in the church. Now 47% do. That's declining about 1% point every year for the last generation. And so people, they don't believe in anything anymore, anything important, anything eternal, anything worthy. And we are getting a nation that is in serious decline. But a little bit reminiscent, I teach a course in European economic history every once in a while. It reminds me of the Roman Empire, the time of Jesus Christ was born. We had moved away from the Roman Republic into the Roman Empire period.
Right.
And within 100, 200 years, everything starts declining and declining a lot. And I'm more worried that we're starting to move into that era. And can we reverse it? And we, in the past, you know, we've been able to reverse these things. We had, you know, look at all the adversity our nation has faced over the centuries, starting with Valley Forge, with George Washington, or Abraham Lincoln, the Civil War, or Pearl Harbor, 9/11. We've had some pretty serious challenges to our nation, and yet we bounced back and we have done it. But can we bounce back from this? I'm wondering.
Yeah, no, I mean, I go to this routinely. This time now is reminiscent of the time before the Roman Republic fell. And about 10 years before that happened, the Roman historian Livy said the problem with the Republic at present is that we can tolerate neither our vices nor their cures. And it seems to me that's sort of where we're at.
Yeah, that's a very nice, that's beautiful, yeah.
Professor Richard Vedder, Emeritus Professor of Economics at Ohio U, Senior Fellow at the Independent Institute, and author of Restoring the Promise, Higher Education in America. Professor Vedder, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be with you. Thanks, Dan. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida had a good day on Tuesday, primary election in Florida. A good day in that he got Charlie Crist back as an opponent. This guy's run for every office imaginable in the last 15 years.
Changed parties. Maybe, you know, he might become an independent someday. Who knows?
Whatever it takes. DeSantis is pressing the pedal down when it comes to responding to the news of the day. Listen to what Ron DeSantis had to say this week on the occasion of Tony Fauci's announced retirement.
And I'm just sick of seeing him. I know he says he's going to retire. Someone needs to grab that little elf and chuck him across the Potomac.
Oh. Grab that little elf and chuck him across the Potomac.
That's violent rhetoric.
We're getting ready for 2024 primary once he gets reelected in November. But the more important news,
yes,
25 of the 30 school board members endorsed by DeSantis won or advanced in their races, campaigning on parental rights, transparency, school choice, and safety. They won three elections in Sarasota County. That creates a 4-1 majority. They also scored two big wins in Miami-Dade, which now becomes the largest U.S. school district with a conservative school board majority.
Oh, I just got the chills.
Both school boards voted last year to mandate the students keep wearing masks, defying parents and Florida law. And now they have changed. The hands of control of those boards are different. So, again, perhaps a bellwether for what we'll see, not just in November, but in school board races around the country next year as well. Campaigning on the issues of parental control, educational choice, more important than ever. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Mark Bauerlein, professor of English at Emory University, senior editor at First Things, and author of The Dumbest Generation, and most recently, The Dumbest Generation Grows Up. I can't wait to see how they turned out. Professor Bauerlein, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Amy. And all hail Lori Lightfoot.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, indeed. Well, we can talk about that, too, if you'd like. But the elections in Florida combined with the headlines around the country of the depopulation of big school districts like in L.A. and Chicago and New York. How should we interpret what's happening?
I think that some conservatives are finally waking up to a reality that the left has understood for 100 years. And that is, you've got to think long term. You've got to pinpoint the small victories that often go under the radar. So that, who would have thought school boards were so important 10 years ago? Right. Who would have thought a local county election commissioner would be so critical to the fate of this country? Well, the left did. And who would have thought that these Soros district attorneys would be able to get in under the radar the way they did many years ago? Well, again, progressives understand the way in which, as Barack Obama or Chicago and Barack Obama put it, we're going to fundamentally transform the United States. Well, one of the ways we do it is these small local elections that get so little attention. And what the outcome in Florida shows is that if you bring the attention of the broad swath of the American people to the kind of candidates that progressives have been putting into office, you win. Because one of the things that the apparent challenges the school boards showed a year ago was just how many wackos are on these school boards, how many high-handed local politicians who have contempt for the very people that they're supposed to represent are getting into these positions. And that's where they push unpopular ideas about LGBTQ in second grade and critical race theory, where you're asking all the kids to line up by race and confess their privilege or their victimhood. This shows that finally real grassroots may be happening, and that Florida should be a lesson to Republican operatives in local states all across the country.
Well, I don't know if you're familiar with up here, Glenview, Illinois. We have the most horrific school board member, Mr. Trobe, who was using obscenities and refused to go and told a guy to put a mask on his blanking balls. Did you see that?
I didn't see that one, but it certainly doesn't surprise me. Remember, these are true believers. These are people who do not accept pluralistic ideas about American democracy, the republic. They refuse to accept any kind of dissent that falls under their power, and they love having that power. it is intoxicating to a progressive to tell people what to do, because they know. They know the utopia that we would have if only we got rid of the bad people and made everyone else conform. Again, they are true believers. They are disciples, and you better get out of their way if you want to enjoy the freedom we have.
And something that David Mamet said in an interview with Adam Carolla about a month ago, I think is really salient. It's really explanatory, and it's only become worse as we've moved into the My Truth generation, which is that the one thing that they cannot tolerate, the new Marxists, is irrelevancy. That's what they cannot tolerate. And so, you know, they will say and do whatever it takes to be present in other people's lives, and thus the manifestations of virtue signaling you see, you know, all over the place, including in the schools.
This is one way in which conservatives have been at a disadvantage in the political scheme, because we are about, hey, leave me alone, okay? Don't tread on me. Let me live my life. And so conservatives have gone about doing that. Well, progressives don't think that way. They don't want to leave you alone because, again, they know best. There is a little totalitarian inside them itching to get out. And when they get that power, again, they love it. And so what conservatives have to realize, yeah, is they're not going to leave you alone. They want you to go away. All right. They want us to die. They want conservatives to disappear. And the fact that we're still around, it just drives them crazy. This is why they hate Trump even more now than they did, you know, 6 years ago when he surprised everyone. He just won't go away. And I mean, all the things Hillary couldn't, all the Republican candidates couldn't stop him. Hillary couldn't stop him. Russia, the Mueller gang couldn't stop him. The intelligence community, they can't make him go away. They made him lose in 2020, but he's still around. And they're thinking, oh my God, the inconceivable happened in 2016. It can happen here. It can happen again in 2024. This is why just about everything in the Democratic Party can be explained by the factor of how do we keep Trump away in 2024. I think everything else is secondary to that.
You wrote recently in Am Greatness about the plight of the progressive teacher, you know, in sort of as we see this movement away from the big government school systems. And I wonder how you see, how you interpret how they're receiving the mass exodus from their school districts that's going on.
Dan, I think what you said a moment ago really applies, the irrelevancy. The progressive teacher in third grade who wants to make all of her students into progressive social change agents finds that the students are leaving the classroom. We got 3 or 4% of students who have left the public schools in the last year. New York City is going to have 30,000 fewer students this year than last year. And last year was another big drop. And they have to say, wait a minute, I'm such a great teacher. I care so much about students. I care so much about the world. I want to make this world a better place. And I'm losing students. That's the irrelevancy factor. And they just can't absorb the fact that we don't like you. We don't want to be right. We think that you are a control freak. We don't like what you're teaching students in classrooms. Why are you not satisfied just teaching reading, writing, arithmetic in fourth grade? Why do you have to bring in all the social issues, all the current events? Well, because you're an indoctrinator. You're not a teacher. They just can't accept that. Me? An indoctrinator? But I have so much virtue. I care so much about people. I want everyone to be happy. They cannot go there and look in the mirror and say, wait a minute, maybe I'm the problem. So, I'm the reason that they may be leaving. That would blow their mind, okay? Because the progressive, again, has total faith in his own goodness, his own benevolence.
Right.
It would shatter the awful things.
Shatter the self-image. Yeah.
Right. Right. And so that's very hard for people to do. And what they end up doing is like Charlie Crist in the interview the other day. He remember? Did you see the clip where he tells all those people who support Ron to say, "I don't want him. I don't want this." Right. They have hate in their heart, and he had no idea. Do you know how much your voice, Charlie, drips with hate when you accuse other people of having hate in their heart? Total projection and total incognizance of how they sound. It's remarkable.
You know, it reminds me of a memoir that was written by a Syracuse English professor, or literature professor, I think she was, Mary Carr, called The Liars Club. And one of the things that was interesting, her intellectual development, she said, you know, for the longest time I used to think, right, for the longest time I thought that if it came from my head, that it had to be right because I'm a good person. It took a long time for me to take what I was thinking and bump it up against some standard of truth that existed outside of me. And ultimately she was talking about Christianity. But it seems to me that's exactly the dynamic that so much of the champagne socialists exhibit.
I think it is hard for people on the outside of academia or even in the public school system to understand the mindset. I mean, I was an academic for 30 years. I was an Emory University professor. I just retired two years ago, and I was a big liberal throughout the 80s and 90s in grad school and assistant professor. And everyone there really shares this sort of worldview. You don't even think about it. It's the air you breathe. We are the good people. We are the enlightened ones. We know better. And we look at those people who went to the Trump rallies, and all we see are stupid cretins and troglodytes.
Then when did you change
nasty,
and why?
Nasty human beings.
Yeah, when did
you know? It was a slow process. I think I just got tired of all the conformity in academia. I saw a lot of illiberal behavior setting in, and you know, the intolerance happening. And then I just started reading other things. You know, I read National Review when it was a good magazine back in 2000, and the Weekly Standard, and just opening my eyes. And the interesting thing is, in these little conformity enclaves, what you find is if you just sort of come up with one little disagreement, they sense that. They have radar for a wavering soul.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If you agree with them 19 times but then disagree on the 20th, you're suspect.
We got everything is a loyalty test. Everything is a loyalty test.
And
we got a problem with Mark on the trans issue. Stat, get over here. Yeah.
and if you, once you've sort of done the click, you can call it, you know, you take a little bit of the red pill, you then see their reaction to your minor dissent, and then you move a little further away. You say, oh, wait a minute. Well, wait, I thought you guys are always about the lone individual, you know, the courageous voice. Going against the grain, you know, striking against the powers that be. Wait a minute. You guys are the powers that be.
Right.
Hey, you know, come on. You know, how you call yourself the resistance when you've got academia, the media, corporate America, you've got state government. Everyone is on your side, but you call yourself the resistance. Give me a break.
It is. They think they're the protagonists in Ayn Rand novels, and they're the antagonists. They've got it 100%, you know, 180 degrees off. Mark Bauerlein, professor of English retired professor of English from Emory University, senior editor of First Things, author of The Dumbest Generation and the follow-up, The Dumbest Generation Grows Up. Professor Bauerlein, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Anytime.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
morning, Dan and Amy. And before we get to our topic this segment, thanks to Ken Jarish, Jarish Bakery.
Yeah, in Elk Grove, right?
Just stopped by and brought a bunch of delicacies for us to enjoy.
You took the coconut donut.
I did.
Quinn brought the knife out so we could cut the donuts in half so we could do this thing called sharing.
There's like 20 donuts in there. What are you talking about?
But that's the only one with coconut on it.
No, you've got one with coconut on it.
No, you took the only coconut.
Well, you were cutting a different donut, so I took the coconut donut. Yeah, I mean, that's what you do. You got to fight for yourself out there in this world. It's a dog-eat-dog world out there. Donut-eat-donut world out there. Wait, you want to see that? Wait till the rest of the staff gets here today.
Oh, hey.
That place is going to be laid waste.
It's not like this. They're coming.
Exactly.
Free food in the cafeteria.
It's like Pamplona. All right, we have to talk more serious topics than breakfast delicacies.
Yes.
China, the Chinese communists, are they preparing to go to war? As many have observed, do they sense an opportunity to take Taiwan, given the weakness of this administration, the preoccupation in Ukraine? Well, to help us answer that question, seems to have some new information from his contacts. Pleased to be welcoming back Gordon Chang to the show. Gordon Chang is an author of The Coming Collapse of China, also The Great U.S.-China Tech War. His Twitter handle, if you want to follow him on Twitter, Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, the letter G, C-H-A-N-G, Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. Gordon Chang, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much, Dan and Amy.
So do you sense that a military action is imminent from President Xi?
I don't know if action is imminent, but we do know one thing, and that is China is preparing for war. And this is not just a question of getting its military ready. It's also mobilizing civilians. There was a very disturbing conversation that I had a few weeks ago where a Chinese entrepreneur who was making medical equipment for civilian use was approached by local officials, told that he was no longer making those items, that he would be making things for the military. And this was not just an isolated incident. He was saying that other factory owners were also told by the Communist Party to start mobilization. And that's a real indication that the Chinese regime is getting ready, not just the military, but all of society to go pick on somebody and have a war.
Well, is this thinking about this because they think this is an opportune time, given what I was saying before about where the U.S. is, its our preoccupation with Ukraine, the weakness of Biden, or is it because of the weakness of China's economy and they need a distraction and an opportunity for the communists to generate sort of the rallying around the flag effect?
It's both, but I think it's more the latter one. And the reason is we know the Chinese economy is in distress. It looks like it's contracting. And what is even more ominous, and that is that Beijing's stimulus measures don't seem to be working because nobody really wants to borrow because they don't see a future. The only thing that's keeping China going is exports, and that could dry up. So right now, I think Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, knows that he is considered to be the author of domestic policies that are failing. And it's not just the economy. You've got the worst heat wave in history. You have the COVID lockdowns. It's just one thing after another. These simultaneous crises are hitting China.
And talk more about the COVID lockdowns, because they're still experiencing them. I mean, they have a zero COVID tolerance policy.
That's right. And that zero COVID tolerance policy is making it very difficult for the economy to recover because people don't know. They can't plan. They might be locked down for weeks. This was dramatically illustrated in Shanghai, but these lockdowns are now the rest of the country. And basically, the regime is at the mercy of COVID-19. Its policies for the last couple of years really haven't worked, and now it doesn't know what to do. The United States and other countries basically have herd immunity. China does not.
Well, I don't know if you saw the video. I think it was in Shanghai. Our producer showed it to me. People were shopping at an IKEA, and then there was a contact trace to that shopping, to a kid that was in that shopping mall, and they locked everybody inside the IKEA store. Did you see that?
They do that. That's just insane. But it's also, for instance, they will lock down an entire district because the regular testing has turned up 4 asymptomatic cases, which happened recently in, I believe, Shanghai. But, you know, the more recent ones, Hainan, the tourist island, was basically locked down because of the presence of a few cases. And this has really been popping up all over China. It's disrupted supply chains. It's disrupted local life. People are not very happy with this for a lot of reasons. But the Communist Party, for its own political reasons, not reasons relating to the disease, but for its own political reasons, won't change a policy that is obviously not working.
So how did the Chinese communists receive the Pelosi visit? And then now there's been a bunch of politicians that have gone over to Taiwan to get their photo ops. The attention the West is playing to Taiwan, how is that received? Is that just a recognition that it's sort of photo op politics and it's not taken particularly seriously? Or is it received in a different manner?
Beijing is going on a bender, I can understand the photo op nature of it, but if politicians don't go, then the worst elements in the Chinese political system will be emboldened and legitimized by showing that threats of intimidation work. So Beijing has created a confrontation which the United States can't back down. And it's not just the United States politicians going to Taipei. It's before Speaker Pelosi went, it was Japan. Now Canadian legislators are going. This shows the world, and it shows China, that Taiwan has support, which is important, and that is deterrence. The problem is that President Biden is not deterring China over Taiwan. So if Biden won't do it, then somebody's got to step up, because this could be the start of the Third World War, largely because we've already got war in Ukraine, war spreading to the eastern part of the Eurasian landmass. There's many other hotspots in the world that could erupt. We are on the edge of perhaps the most destructive war in history because of the failure of Biden policy to deter Russia and China.
When you talk about preparing for war and not knowing whether it's imminent or not, but the preparing for war, getting war production in line, is it limited to Taiwan as the focus, or could we see Chinese communists intervene on behalf of the Russians? Could we see them open a front in another theater?
Yeah, Chinese troops are already in Indian-controlled territory in Ladakh and the Himalayas, and they're preparing for another push southwards. China's been trying to break apart the Philippines at Second Thomas Shoal with a number of serious incidents of last November and this July. Chinese warships have been in Japanese territorial waters in the East China Sea, around the Senkakus. It could be anywhere, Dan. And so it's not just Taiwan. This is a militant regime that is determined to conquer and to kill.
There was this story, too. And then what's U.S. policy towards China is the next, bank of questions. The story. Here we go again. These self-inflicted wounds, it seems to me. A University of Maryland professor, Dinesh Manocha, who is a scholar in AI, artificial intelligence, and robotics, created machine learning software useful for surveillance that can read people's personalities and predict their behavior. He did it under a 6-figure research grant from Alibaba, which is, of course, the Chinese tech giant. And this what Alibaba wanted from Professor Manocha at University of Maryland is development of software to classify the personality of each pedestrian and identify other biometric features. So, and the capabilities will be used to predict the behavior of each pedestrian and are useful for surveillance. So now we have, professors at American universities. This is sort of the Confucius Institute approach here, getting grants not from governments directly, but from their instrumentalities like Alibaba, and where our brain power is being used to help the Chinese communists build out their surveillance state. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
No, this is wrong. And the American people, of course, should be upset that the Chinese are developing this totalitarian state, no longer authoritarian. It's really semi-totalitarian. But we should also be angry at our own leaders that have permitted this. After all, this is our country. We can prevent these technology transfers, but yet they've been promoted. And it's not just the current occupant of the White House. It's all of his predecessors that have let this continue. But this has got to stop, because what this does is it's a national security threat to the United States. We are helping China oppress its people. That is absolutely 100%. No question about it. That's wrong.
Yeah, I'd say so. And something else, too, with respect to U.S. policy, there was talk a couple of weeks ago. There's been legislation filed that would prohibit Chinese communist-connected investors, Chinese nationals connected to the Communist Party, from buying up farmland. There's talk of other limitations, farmland in this country. The reaction is somewhat mixed with people who believe in private property rights and want to attract foreign investment. And you say, well, you know, they're going to take over the United States. Well, this is the same thing people said about the Japanese when they bought Rockefeller Center in the 80s. And that was over the top and it was overheated. And obviously it didn't happen. So what should we understand about some of these big investments that are being made in farmland in this country and our larger posture towards foreign investment from individuals connected to the Chinese Communist Party?
And also Chinese individuals not connected to the Chinese Communist Party. There are this is not like the Japanese making commercial decisions to buy Pebble Beach or Rockefeller Center. You know, this is different. We have seen, for instance, the Chinese buy land, use it for criminal purposes. We also have indications that they are using it for espionage. For instance, that 300 acres bought by Fufeng Group in North Dakota within 12 miles of Grand Forks Air Force Base, and also the purchase near Laughlin Air Force Base in Texas. We don't know what the Chinese are doing with this farm and ranch land, and so I believe that we should prohibit all Chinese purchases of farm and ranch land in the U.S. until we figure out what's going. And when we know that Chinese parties have been using their land for criminal purposes, we should use the federal forfeiture statutes, just take the land. And I also believe that until we find out what's going on, the United States should expropriate Chinese purchases. And where there's no criminal activity, we should just pay compensation. But until we figure out what's going on, Dan, this is a threat, especially because the Chinese are doing some very strange things with their purchases. We haven't been able to figure that out, but we know they can't be up to any good.
He is Gordon Chang. He's the author of The Coming Collapse of China and The Great U.S.-China Tech War. You can follow him on Twitter at Gordon G. Chang, C-H-A-N-G, Gordon G. Chang is his Twitter handle. Gordon Chang, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Dan and Amy. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, so I must be over the target because the entirety of the Chicago political power structure, which would include Governor Pritzker and Mayor Lightfoot and the Chicago Press Corps, is trying to morally indignant me into
taking the ad down.
Taking this ad that I put up on the Safety Act down, detailing with supporting commentary from suburban prosecutors what the Safety Act would mean for the rest of the state, not named Cook County, where it's de facto the way that Kim Fox does her business, in my estimation. And I think the evidence is pretty overwhelming. But this all is attempting to be distracted by Lori Lightfoot claiming she's some sort of victim of racism, of dog whistling. And this is what she said the other day.
But to use the oldest racist tropes that there are to make the scary black woman even blacker, to show scary black men on TV, and to say to the suburbs, i.e. the white people, you don't want this coming to your town, so vote for Darren Bailey. That is a height of racism and cynicism.
Well, first of all, the suburbs, i.e. white people, the suburbs are not i.e. white people.
So rude.
This just in, you know, the collar counties are a fifth to a quarter minority. I'm talking about DuPage. I'm talking about Lake. Obviously, suburban Cook County has significant minority populations as well. So that's just wrong. The footage that was used in the spot, just to repeat, is all news footage. It's all things that have been aired on network affiliate newscasts in the city.
Or on and CWB.
It's not just limited to black men. But it's interesting to me. She always focuses on the perpetrator. What about the victims? What about the victims in the Summer of Joy, the 214 people who have been murdered since June 21st in Lori Lightfoot's Summer of Joy, the 1,200 people, round numbers, who've been shot in the Summer of Joy, just in the Summer of Joy, just since June 21st? Well, it turns out, as we've made mention anytime we've talked about the subject, that 80% plus of the victims are black residents of Chicago. So who speaks for them? It doesn't appear that it's Lightfoot, Fox, Pritzker. What about, I mean, and by the way, they're presented in the actual crime footage. That is, I mean, we've got one. She doesn't know where these things took place. We got the black culinary student who was shot in Lincoln Park for his cell phone.
The Puerto Rican Day Parade shooting. The flag that's right by her house. Everybody in the world saw that video.
So
this is from Chicago. This is just another smoke and mirrors. We're trying to distract. And then she said, "Well, no, Amy, I've got proof." I'm like, well, "Okay, well, where is it? What's your proof? Show me."
The proof is you know, one version of the video from her City Club speech versus how she's presented in my commercial, and it's a little bit darker in the commercial because of the graphics package. It has nothing to do with changing anyone's skin pigmentation. It's a ridiculous, insane, pathetic assertion, which I've been saying for the last 48 hours. Can't even conceive somebody would make this allegation. But then, you know, with Lori Lightfoot, there is no bottom. With J.B. Pritzker, there is no bottom.
Yeah, Governor Pritzker wants you to take it down.
This is how shameless they are, these race hustlers. So that's my view. So the question becomes, well, who's blowing the dog whistle? Is it me or is it Lori Lightfoot? For conversation about that, please be joined by Democrat State Rep LaShawn Ford, who is from the west side of the city, represents the west side of the city. LaShawn, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, Dan, Amy, I'm glad to be here. You know, I'll go anywhere to have a discussion about the problems that we're having in the city and the state.
Well,
and I appreciate you guys talking about it.
Yeah.
As a black man with really dark skin.
So what you're sort of intimating, but so what about that? What about that assertion that Lightfoot made?
Well, I mean, of course, we live in America and people could make assertions all they want. I've been in politics for over 15 years, and it's the job of the opponent to put out ads that they see. And as a candidate, I mean, you have to have tough skin if you're in politics, especially if you're playing at the level of mayor. And I really, really think that you have to pick your battles. And this is not the battle that I think we need to be focusing on as a negative. I don't need anybody saying the darker you look, the more dangerous you are. That's bad. And so I find it offensive that we focus on saying that that's a ugly vision of a person because that person is darker.
That's what Lori Lightfoot said.
Yeah,
that's what I mean. I find that it takes us back, you know, in America where you have images of black people that have, you know, that people have been discriminated because of darker skin. And so even if you had intentions on whatever, you pick your battles. And to say that because you made me darker, that means I'm scary to white people.
Yeah.
That's not right. And and so what we need to do is embrace all colors. And you can't expect your opponent to put you in the best light when they're trying to defeat you. I know this, you know, so you're not going to give her best image for ad that you're trying to convey a message. Now, if you're trying to convey a message that she's darker than she is and that makes her bad, then that's your prerogative. But I don't see how being darker makes the mayor of the city of Chicago threatening white suburban.
Well, it's also so ridiculous because it's like everybody knows who she is and what her skin color is. This is not like in controversy. It's not a topic of discussion, which is why you can never even conceive of this allegation being made. This is like J.B. Pritzker arguing about being presented as fat on screen. Like, oh, no, you know, you got me from the wrong angle. You made me look fat. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Everybody knows the physical characteristics of people who have been omnipresent in our lives, particularly because of the every other day press conferences we had for 2 years during the pandemic. So it's just silliness to suggest that I'm introducing a figure that people don't know anything about in order to scare people.
Right. Let me tell you, and this is the truth, whether you're a white person or a black person, when you go into the Secretary of State office or you go take a passport picture, or you go do anything, everyone wants their picture to look pretty accurate and even enhanced to make them look better. But you don't come out against the color of your skin when it could really make person that color be offended. I mean, the color that you had her in is just a little shade darker than me. And so we cannot play, even if you are offended, you have to have thicker skin to avoid that issue.
Yeah.
Well, do you think
you just can't do it?
Yeah.
Do you think the black community, is upset at all with this ad or just,
you know, her? I don't think so. I don't think the black community is upset at it. I mean, when I think about, ads that have been put forth, I've seen ads of white people darkened too.
Yeah.
I've seen it happen. Now, we know that there's such thing as racism and there's a such thing as, you know, in society that you want to make people look scary. You know, I mean, you just got to have tough skin and pick your battles. Well, and this is not one that you go into to highlight, to make it, and you as a person confirming that because I'm darker, I'm scarier. That's her confirming that because she's darker, she's scarier. She validated, even if you had intentions on making that assumption, she validated it. Mm. And that's offensive.
Mm. What about my perspective on it is this is just a naked misdirection play because of the endemic violent crime in the city of Chicago and to some extent in the suburbs and the arguments that they do not want to have, particularly Pritzker, about the Safety Act and about no cash bail. And we may have some disagreements on criminal justice reform, but just as a matter of politics, is this what you see them doing? They don't want to engage on the merits. They don't want to have to discuss their record. So it's just easier to play the race card or try.
No,
to?
I think that the governor supported the mayor. And the governor came out supporting the mayor. She was offended, and he supports her and says that I'm going to back her up.
Right.
And that's it. But as far as the Safety Act, I think that the governor and me as a legislator, there are some things in that Safety Act that I could defend without a doubt. And there are things that Safety Act has done to reverse some of the challenges that our criminal justice system has had over the years that has cost taxpayers billions of dollars. So, you know, there are laws on the books before the Safety Act were bad, and they have been improved as a matter of fact with the Safety Act, and the work continues to improve our laws on the books. You know, what the mayor should be doing instead of talking about those suburban people is, look, I represent 8 different communities. I represent suburban, western suburbs. And we need to work with LaGrange, LaGrange Park, North Riverside, Oak Park, Berwyn. And we have to come together with those mayors and police chiefs to do everything that we can to put our law enforcement together to stop these criminals from their criminal activities. And that should be the focus, not focusing on the white people in those communities that's afraid of criminals.
Yeah, see, I mean, this is like what an adult conversation looks like, which you don't get, and the Chicago Press Corps wouldn't cover even when you do get it. I disagree with you on the Safety Act. You know that, and I know,
yep,
I know where
but
you
I
are.
Can tell you.
Yeah, but I mean,
talk
but we're
about one measure. Let's talk yeah. about the bond, bail bond.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I think that when you talk about having a system in place like eliminating the bail bond, right now the judges have several options when they decide how they're going to rule to keep a person in jail pre-trial or let them out. They could give them a bail. They could put them on house arrest. They could just give them an I bond. Right now, guess what? The discretion is on the judge now to say, you are a threat to the community. I have two options. I'm going to keep you in jail pre-trial, or I'm going to let you out. I'm going to sign you out and say that you're no threat.
Yeah, but the problem, LaShawn,
that's great.
The problem with that, though, I mean, the legislation is that you all the presumptions are changed, and so the presumption for a range of violent crimes that I highlighted in my ad, like aggravated assault and arson and kidnapping, the presumption is for release, and the idea of showing making the claims for a cause to threat to the community, and thus that person needs to be held over, or there needs to be some cash bond attached. It's just a very high burden that this law now puts into place. And what you have career prosecutors telling us, Democrats like Glasgow and Will County, and Republicans like Berlin and DuPage, and many, many others around the state, is that the reality of how this is going to work with those presumptions and the standards for threat to the public that have to be met is you're going to have people that are charged with serious violent crimes turn back on the street, just as you've seen happen in Cook County under Fox as sort of her culture, even though it's not the law yet.
Yeah, I don't think that that's the case, because what you're going to have, when we're talking about America and society, you want the presumption of innocence.
Well, yes.
And you need to make sure that you deviate and you make sure that you look at every case. And you look at whether this is a habitual criminal, first-time offender, and the judge, believe me, when you have a judge that has to sign a order, they are going to look at it carefully, and they're going to keep criminals locked up. And they're going to keep habitual criminals locked up pre-trial, whereas today people are able to leave. Violent people that have been charged are able to leave and go out on bail. That won't happen anymore. This bill, this law, the Safety Act, will save taxpayers millions and billions of dollars, because we know that people have been locked up for minor offenses that may have been misdemeanors, and it's cost taxpayers millions and billions of dollars over the years. Those people will not be locked up in county jails anymore, and taxpayers will be grateful for that. We're going to have more space to keep those hardened criminals in pretrial.
Well, I mean, look, first of all, in these jails, you talk to the prosecutors, that you're not talking to people that have like a low-level drug offense. You're talking to people that have allegedly committed serious crimes. And you just see it everywhere, LaShawn. I mean, look, we mentioned this before, Yolo County prosecutor, this is the Sacramento area in California, they did a study of the 595 persons released on zero bail between 20 and 21 when no cash bail went into effect there. 70% were arrested for violent crimes such as murder, attempted murder, kidnapping, robbery, carjacking, or domestic violence while released on zero bail pending a trial on unrelated offenses. And we've seen that happen in Chicago, too. So, it's what prosecutors are saying, what sheriffs are saying, combined with a real world experience of places like New York and California, where they're slightly ahead of us on this.
Yeah, I think that what this is going to require is for everybody to step up and do their job right. That means, one, the legislature has to make sure that we do everything we can to have the best laws on the books, and we are set off at a good start right now. And it's going to mean that police officers are going to have the training that they need to write good police reports to send to the prosecutors for indictments. And it means that the prosecutors are going to have to do their homework and give a good case to prove that this person is a danger to society before it gets to the judge. If everyone does their job
time.
Like adults,
they need more time. They're going to have to be out on bond or no cash bond.
90-day clock.
Days.
Right.
Right.
No. The judge at any time, your attorney, you can hold the person in jail because if the case goes before the judge, then there's a case right there where the judge is going to have to determine whether or not a person should be released or not. So there's time there. That's the time.
You have to present that person as a threat to a specific individual. And it can't be some generic, we believe he's a threat to the public order. Specifically, who is this person a threat to?
No, that's not true.
It is true.
Yes.
Bob Berlin, the DuPage County State's Attorney, said exactly that in this show. And frankly, that's what the language says.
Yeah, you know what? It would be true for things like domestic violence or things like that. But if you are a person that's out there committing crimes like carjacking, I mean, you are going to be held in jail without bail. That's what the communities want. And that means that when the police arrest this person, they're going to have good evidence. They're going to present it to the prosecutor. Prosecutor will present a great case. And guess what? We need to be working with our prosecutors to make sure that they understand that they go before the judge and demand that they are retained. That's what we need.
All right, LaShawn, you get the last word. State Representative LaShawn Ford from the west side of the city into the suburbs, as he was just describing. LaShawn, appreciate your time on this, the conversation, and that you're, an independent thinker and willing to call balls and strikes, even where we have disagreements. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan and Amy. Bye-bye.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one, Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.